One thing you'll begin to notice as we flesh out all the different ways is that there is a lot of overlap. There's something distinctive about each of the ways, but also overlaps with all the others, to varying degrees. I have grouped these two ways together, way five and way six, because they're very much like twin horses pulling a carriage. And they are perspiration and inspiration. Perspiration and inspiration. And I often call them graft and grace. Graft and grace. And I wrote something in my journal years and years ago, and I was looking at this, and I've pulled it out. I have it here. More often than not, the process of writing poetry seems almost meteorological, a spontaneous condensation, a thick vapor that creeps under the door of your brightly lit life and demands that you investigate. The rest is trying to get the blasted door to open. So that was my kind of analogy for the unexpected thing, the thought fox padding up the stairs, but then the hard work that one may have to do to realize it. Or not. So it's like the scales of a balance, which may on one poem tilt mostly towards perspiration and on another poem tilt mostly towards inspiration. It may vary from minute to minute. So I've put them together like the scales of a balance. So there is hard work always in writing somewhere. Even if you find writing very easy, there will be some part of the process that requires the hours and the research and the check-in and the rethinking and the building of experience and the honing of skills. And among all this, because this is my course on this, I'm always going to be very interested in the unconscious, the unconscious. So, how crafty are we with our unconscious? Bit of a pun on that one. How crafty can we get with our unconscious? Can we bring craft to the unconscious as well as the conscious? So the saying goes, it's 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration. I think for me, it's more often 1% inspiration, 9% perspiration, and 90% evaluation. And again, you might want to bring a third scale into this kind of weird 3D balance, and you may find your weightings are different to that. I find I don't need a great deal of inspiration, and it's not horrific work to create a poem, but most of my time is then spent thinking it through, wondering about it, seeing where it leads, checking everything I can think to check. Are there any cliches, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there is a special case of perspiration, and that's the graft of translation. There's a special case of perspiration, which is translation, breaking stones for pleasure, as Heaney put it. Breaking stones for pleasure. That was Heaney. And translation is something I've been thinking of a lot in recent years. I've done a few, whereas my early work, there was nothing, no translations. I've done quite a few, Catullus, Sappho, Hafez, Saadi, Rumi, Montale, Jacques Prévert. Some of those are published, some not. And that's the obvious form of translation between languages. But there are other forms of translation about which one can shed some perspiration. One of those might be between forms. Not rewriting a poem in a different language, but I think Zoe will like this idea, writing into different forms. So you're using the same words and you're distributing them differently according to what we might loosely call form. And then ultimately, translating yourself. not translating one author's words into another language and pretending they're still the same author. One might translate oneself, one's being, one's experience, one's not just one's words in thinking, but different aspects of the self could be translated into poems. So when you think of perspiration, making something work, it's not just the hours and the effort of standard conventional thinking, reading, research, editing. There are very many activities that can be work. And again, I find that visual artists, painters, sculptors are much more tuned into all of that. Not always, but they kind of know about these different kinds of work. So that led me to the phrase that kind of wraps all of this up neatly and approximately. And you may not agree with this, but it's a kind of starting point. Every writer's life is their own particular negotiation between graft and grace. Every writer's life is their own particular negotiation between graft and grace. That's great.
What was the end of that quote again, please? The negotiation between, was it graft and grace?
That's it. And I find that for myself, you may not find it useful. For myself, it's just a nice, tidy reminder on any particular piece I'm doing. Have I negotiated between graft and grace on this piece? Am I doing too much work? Am I getting wrapped up in the work of it and forgetting the other side? Or am I so hell-bent on it being brilliant and wonderful and amazing and trying to find all the inspiration that I'm not doing the groundwork? I'm not doing the basics. The hours I need to put in. Have I checked the form? Have I done the syllable count? Have I put in all the bits of work that will reveal to me what I've done? And this is a kind of equivalent of what you do with students when they're handing in essays. It happens all the time at the college. This negotiation between you and them. How much work did you put into here? How much thinking and insight have you had? And what was the balance in this particular piece? And was that the right balance for this particular piece? So I like to think of inspiration and perspiration as a married couple. You can work inspiration and you can be inspired about perspiration. They're not mutually exclusive, they become one. So you can work at inspiration and you can be inspired by your work. You're working. So, to give an example of that, maybe some of the perspiration is exploring your habits and experimenting with different creative routes, as we've been doing on the course. And inspire to breathe in. When one is inspired, one breathes in. Maybe we can breathe in consciously as well as unconsciously in writing. So maybe we can make inspiration happen as well as waiting for it to happen in its own terms. So there's this kind of dialogue between inspiration and perspiration, and that opens up two further ways that are very intimately linked. So before we move on to way seven, any thoughts or any questions about that? Graft and grace, ways six and five.
I just was going to say that I think that's really helpful because so often poems can be killed by too much editing, and I think that's what you're saying here, that make sure
Yes.
that you keep the energy.
And especially if you're spending a long time on a book, putting a book together, or a particular poem that you're struggling with, good to check in two or three times a day. Where am I in that balance? And I found that I was doing that without thinking it. But when I began to teach writing a bit more, I began to make that more conscious. I was just doing it without thinking. I didn't even know I'd done it. I was aware that I would do it, just check in with myself. Should I stop working now and just kind of listen to this and merge with it a bit more and kind of be sensitive to it and awaken to it rather than go and find another similar poem and read that one? I've done seven already. So, way seven, shall we move on? Way seven is verbal pickling. Verbal pickling. And I got that from a quote from Larkin. Writing for Larkin was, quote, to construct a verbal device that would preserve an experience indefinitely by reproducing it in whoever reads the poem. I'll say that again. For Larkin, writing a poem was, quote, to construct a verbal device that would preserve an experience indefinitely by reproducing it in whoever reads the poem. I love that and I hate it. I love it because it captures something really essential about why we write. We're trying to save something from entropy, from the passing of time, from forgetfulness, from ambiguity, from anonymity. And for many writers I've met and taught, and for myself, writing, among other things, is certainly a way of preserving some part of my being for someone else to have, maybe beyond my own lifetime. There's some element of that. But the way Larkin constructs his definition is riddled with holes. Can we just look at some of the holes of Larkin's? I mean, Larkin is a brilliant writer, and there's some wonderful stuff in there. He's very good on Wilfred Owen, but he makes a lot of assumptions. And in a short quote like that, there's about 20. To construct a verbal device that would preserve an experience indefinitely by reproducing it in whoever reads the poem. Can we, just as an exercise in not taking everything at face value and challenging things, what are the assumptions in there that are not always so? Just pitch in, remember to unmute.
It might not be verbal.
Exactly.
Might not be autobiographical.
Good, yeah. We might not construct it, we might just hear it. Or feel it. Construct it implies a very mechanical process, but some of us don't construct poems. They just kind of splurge or arrive and something else happens, but it's not quite construction, like a scaffolding, and it's all very orderly and so on. What else would you contend with in that very short quote?
It might not reproduce the experience exactly. It might induce something in the reader.
Discounts the whole of reader-oriented theory. I mean, 50 years of deep critical global theory on writing and reading that says you can never reproduce the experience in someone else precisely, and you can never really determine what that reader will get from you. One person will find your poem an enlightening treatise on love, and somebody else thinks it's a load of crap. You can't control that. You can engineer some degree of influence, but you can never control it. So to reproduce or preserve an experience, no. You can try to, and there's a lot in that that's true, but you won't preserve it as you intend it, usually. I wonder how those First World War poets who wrote all those jingoistic verses about let's all go to war, lads, and kill the Hun would feel now about the way they're read as infantile and rather silly. To have thought that. Is there any more? I would never think of a poem as a device. Not a gadget, is it really? Anything else?
I was going to say that the poem isn't always about an experience. Poems are quite abstract. You're not necessarily writing an experience down.
Yes, yes. Yeah, precisely. So although it's a lovely quote and it does capture something, it's Swiss cheese. It's definitely, but let's run with the Swiss cheese, yeah, for a bit. The question I would have for Larkin is, if you're pickling this experience so that years later someone can find the jar and eat the pickle, is the poem the onion or the vinegar? Because I think Larkin thinks it's the onion. But sometimes I think it's the vinegar. Or it's at least both. It's not just the experience that's being preserved, but the way you've preserved it, the vinegar, the form, the words you've chosen, the way you've presented the poem, that's the kind of vinegar preserving this experience that the words represent, which, especially to people like the language poets and the modernists, would be at least as important as the onion of the experience. If you could think about preserving that experience in prose through a film, a comic, manga, a poem, there'd all be different ways of preserving the onion. They're all different kinds of preservative. One's formaldehyde, the other's vinegar, the other bleach. You know, they're all different forms of preservative, aren't they? The medium, the fluid that preserves. So are you waiting for some suitable vegetable to pickle? Or are you turning yourself into vinegar that pickles anything that comes its way? And I think a lot of writers are looking for the exotic vegetable to pickle. They're going all the way to the tropics and getting themselves down in the undergrowth, looking for this sweet fruit that nobody's found before, and then they'll pickle it with a poem. Well, just bring to mind what you're pickling it with. And maybe that's going to be the chief flavour anyway, probably. I find pickled onions just taste of vinegar mostly. So the onion will absorb the pickling agent, and the pickling agent will leach out some of the juices of the onion. Again, there's always this bleeding of things together, isn't there? So way seven is really about something that you feel compelled to store or save before it goes. Before it goes off, or it turns to mush. And you want to try and preserve it in all its beautiful originality so that someone else can kind of get part of the way there with you by reading what you've written. But of course, you can't guarantee that. I'm going to ask you something. You might think this is completely unrelated, but it's a little bit of physics. Just an afterthought from the other course, which I'm bringing into way seven. You know, when you switch on a kettle that's full of water, cold water from the tap, before it boils, you're aware that there's a kind of hissing sound? Yeah? Do you know what that hissing sound is? Can anyone guess? And it gets louder, and then as it gets really hot, it gets very loud, and then the kettle boils. Do you know what that hiss is? And it can start quite early on. You can switch the kettle on, and within a few seconds, you'll hear this kind of hiss or sizzle. Do you know what that is?
Air?
Nope.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say the gas coming out of the liquid.
Mm. In the manner of speaking, what it is you're switching on the kettle, you're making the plate in the kettle super hot. The water in contact with that plate boils. You get tiny microscopic bubbles of steam, but above them is cold water, so immediately they pop. It's a sound of billions of little bubbles the size of a pinhead forming and popping at an enormous rate. So that hiss is the kind of sound of all those popping balloons of steam, which is quite amazing when you think about it, that you can hear that. Now, why am I saying this? Because is that happening in us all the time? Are we like kettles that are constantly switched on? There's this kind of hiss of things that could form, but are just quenched down before they're even conscious to us. And we're mostly unaware of that process. But there's a kind of creative hiss going on, because we're all kettles with our energy switched on. But there's only once in a while that the kettle actually boils and all the bubbles erupt and steam comes out of the kettle, and there's your poem. You get to boiling point. I'm just trying to make you aware of a process that goes further back than we're often aware of. We're quite aware of the boiling over into a poem. We're there, we're writing the poem. There's all these moments before and leading back to the hiss, which I believe is pretty much constant. Awake or asleep, as long as we're alive, there's some level of hiss going on in the background of creativity that mostly doesn't develop into a boiled kettle. And pickling experience is a little bit like waiting for that kettle to boil. Pickling experience is a little bit like waiting for the kettle to boil. But if you respond to the hiss, maybe you don't always need it to boil. Stretching the analogy a bit, sorry about that. But if you're only waiting for a kettle that boils, you may wait quite some time. But if you're aware of the hiss, you might find that you can get your tea at a lower temperature. So I've just brought that in as a kind of afterthought from the other course. It's kind of relevant to way seven, I think, more than any of the other ways. This idea of waiting for the fully formed onion and then you pick it and you pickle it. But there's a whole process before that onion is fully formed that we can maybe arrive at a poem before the pickling. So you don't have to be subject to the rules of seasons and fully grownness and all the rest. You can find ways to intervene earlier, and the kind of creativity you'll encounter might be different. And I think that's why some people say, because to follow on from last week, oh, the language poets, it's all crap, I don't understand it. Perhaps some of those writers have been used to intervening when the kettle boils, and the hiss for them is just hiss, doesn't mean anything. But a poet who manages to get some meaning out of the hiss is communicating something different, potentially. Just stay with that image for a while, see if it does anything for you. Any thoughts on that? Do you want to reflect back to me anything?
I love the analogy because it's like, it's a feeling of potential if you think about yourself as a hiss and a bubble. And I think that's that writer's block where you feel empty. If you think of yourself as sort of a billion microscopic bubbles of ideas, then I don't know, that there's something encouraging in that idea.
But the like, brain is active all the time, isn't it? Even in sleep. I just can't, as a scientist, I just can't believe that the creative moment of the writing of a poem isn't potentially always possible. With all this activity, I don't believe that it's all segregated into one part of the brain. And then now and again, it leaps across the brain into this inspirational part of the brain that for a few hours is switched on, then it recedes into the dim mist and never returns for weeks on end. I just can't believe that. It just doesn't, feels all wrong to me. Even for people who believe that is their experience of writing and would stand by it to their last breath, I don't believe it. The brain is too complex. There's too much going on all the time. We're finding out more and more about different parts of the brain constantly communicating with each other, even when we're kind of dozing off or watching a really bad film. The parts of the brain are constantly at work. And I think it's about this low-level stuff that could, as you say, potentially always emerge into creativity. Mm. But we're kind of conditioned and educated to wait for that, to be intense enough to see it and then follow it. And I think that seeing could be more perceptual, could be more piercing. We may be able to dig deeper into that process and spot it earlier, and then it will lead us. What do you think, Sally?
I was just going to ask you, do you think that it's quite exhausting sometimes to think? So maybe it's not that there aren't ideas all the time, but to actually follow them with your brain, it can be quite tiring.
A lot of poets and writers end up insane, don't they? I think a lot of artists. There's reason for that.
Well, I just wonder whether that there was sort of energy involved in you know, making it the water boil, you know.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yes and no. I think it depends. I think you can get to a point where it's effortless. I've experienced that. I can't say anything other than what I've experienced on that. But for a while, it was incredibly hard work, like balancing all the plates on sticks and keeping them all spinning. It was exhausting, but it was very rewarding. That effort was very well rewarded. But there were other times when I was getting more used to doing that on a regular basis, when I could just kind of almost click my fingers and it would happen.
It's a bit like an athlete training, isn't it? In a sense.
You know,
you're training your brain, in a sense, to kind of have that sort of, to be more efficient or to be, you know, just training the brain.
And way back when I used to jog and I stopped jogging for a while, starting again was horrific. It needs so much will to overcome the body's resistance and your own mental resistance. But then when you were fit again, you'd go for a run, you think, is that it? I couldn't do 2 laps of the park a year ago, now I'm doing 6 laps easily.
So I'm just wondering if the brain isn't similar.
I reckon it probably is. I can't imagine the brain is entirely foreign to the body. The brain has made the body and the body has made the brain. So there's going to be lots of correlations between these kinds of things, between what the body has and what the brain does. Intuitively, that feels right to me. If we have these experiences with the body, I'm pretty sure they're going to be happening with the brain too. So that's way 7, the verbal pickle. Buy your pickles from Larkin, they're the best. So way 8. This is where most courses start, way 8. A sudden insight or idea. Sudden insight or idea. What Robert Frost used to call a clarification of life, a stay against confusion, end of quote. But it's something that's instantly there for some reason or by some means. It's not something you had to find a way to. It just arrives. It seems so easy to put it down. Often in a few moments, it's already made. Or the essentials of it are made.
Can you just say that Frost quote again, please?
A clarification of life, a stay against confusion. There's just this kind of window that opens and the light pours in and you see it clearly.
Is it in the sort of Chekhovian world of epiphany?
Yeah. Epiphany. I did think of using the term epiphany, but I didn't because it had its connotations of a kind of sacred moment. And sometimes it's very, you know, you just dig in the garden and it happens then. It is a kind of epiphany, but I didn't want to imply the religious connotation that's somehow given to you by something beyond all knowing. And it's just a sudden clarification, an insight. Just, yes, of course. Why didn't I think that before? Why didn't I know that before? Or a form of words. Oh, that's a beautiful phrase. It just comes in and it grows itself into a poem. I'm not going to say much about way 8. All I'm going to say is this. If lightning hits a kite in the storm, buy yourself a kite and go looking for storm. Don't wait for the storm to reach your neighborhood and then go and ask the neighbor if they've got a kite. Go buy a kite and drive off to where the storm is. The sudden insight for many writers, I'm not saying you guys, but for many writers I speak to about this, is something they wait for. And there's all kinds of ways that you can go and get it. You can put yourself in lightning's way. And everyone will find their own ways. I can't say what those are for you. But you'll have ways where you can go and stand in the storm, flying your kite, and you'll get struck by the lightning much more frequently. And that's all about experimentation and knowing yourself and knowing what works for you and remembering what worked for you and putting the, being a bit forensic with this. I get a lot of poems on planes in economy class, balancing the powdered nuts and the tiny little cup of plastic cup of white wine that doesn't taste of anything. They're all written in that place. So I think now I know that planes for me are my kite and my storm. So I bring a pad whenever I fly. So you can go looking for trouble. So those are the four ways I wanted to cover this week. And looking ahead to ways 9 and 10, have a good night's sleep next week before the, because the ways 9 and 10 are huge. They're immense. And they kind of account for me for about 90% of the writing. For you, it might not be that much. Actually, including, if you include 11, which is the week after that, yeah, that'd be about 90%. But ways 9 and 10 are at least half. So ways 9, 10 and 11 are big ones. We've got three really huge ways coming up in the next couple of weeks before our break and after it. So it's the meat of the course, number 9, 10 and 11, are huge. And will be immensely productive and also in many ways familiar. I'm just kind of giving you a little trailer, yeah? Okay, so those are our four ways for this week. And next week we'll go on to a really huge area, perhaps one of the most underrated ways of all of them ever. I won't say any more than that. All right, I'm not saying any more. I want you to go and find anywhere you want to, but let's keep it to poetry for now. It could be something else, it could be prose or a video, but let's keep it poetry for this initially. Go and find a poem that you feel really pickles somebody's experience and makes you feel it. So go and find something that really does that for you and spend some time with that poem. Then put the poem away, and a little while later, or quite a while later, you choose, make your own pickle of something from your own life. So you're going off to find something just so that you've got a kind of way in, because that might help to see how somebody else did it. You don't have to go with that. You can just see it, enjoy it, and then forget all about it if you choose. You might find it gives you a way in, a door. Either way, fine. But then when you're ready, is there an experience you've been wanting to pickle and you haven't found a way to do it? So that I can feel it with you, so others can feel it with you. And it has to be a pickle. You know, you want us to feel this. You want us to know how you felt, or what you knew, or what you thought. You could say all my poems try to do that to some extent, but find a particularly powerful or momentous thing that you really would want to be in your canon. You may have attempted to write about it previously and succeeded, but try it again. If you've already done it, try it again. If you haven't done it, have a go. Without knowing what it might be, I can't give you any more specific instructions, but pickle something for us. So that's your homework. Because the sudden insight idea we know about and the perspiration inspiration we've already discussed is a way of kind of checking in with yourself when you're writing. So this is the one where we're going to make something new, a new piece, to pickle something and then see. Try and find out whether it's an onion or a gherkin, right? So